Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
Evening, Matt. How are you going today?
I'm actually pretty good, Liam. I'm really good. How are you?
Good. Nice and refreshed after that long weekend.
Oh, mate, I absolutely needed it.
Yeah.
And feeling very refreshed, actually, yeah.
We got away up to the Blue Mountains for a bit of a breath of fresh air somewhere, a bit of hiking, and got out there to one of the local breweries up in Katoomba.
Oh, nice. Which one?
Mountain Culture.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Yeah,
just right in the heart of Katoomba there. It was good. It was really good.
A bit different from your last trip to the Blue Mountains.
Oh, I've forgotten that one. Do remind me. No, that was, yeah, what was that? That was back in May, but that seems so long ago.
That was episode, I can't remember.
No, but look, we still got a lot of hiking in, but this time we had the kids, did some hikes that I've never had a chance to do before that I really wanted to. And I'd highly recommend going out to the Glowworm Tunnel. That was amazing.
Oh, yes, I know the Glowworm Tunnel. Yeah, I've been there. Yeah, that is amazing. Yeah,
I've never done that before and I've always wanted to do it. There's a marathon that goes through there, but we got to do it with the kids and it was great. We were lucky the timing when we got there, we just had the whole tunnel to ourselves at that point, which was great.
It's amazing. Yeah.
You know, and then the other one that I highly recommend now that was always recommended to me, I never got to, is the Grand Canyon Walk.
I've done that. Yeah.
That's a beautiful walk too.
Yeah. It is, yeah.
But yeah, enough about me. How's the family going?
Good. Yeah, so our new node is getting very noticeably bigger and stronger every day, mm-hmm. which is good.
So a little bit's been happening over the last couple of weeks, Matt. Don't know if you've noticed, but there's been a bit of press around WordPress.
I see what you did there. Funnily enough, I have noticed, which is surprising because I've barely noticed much of anything. But I couldn't miss that one. That was a bit of a drama.
Yeah, and that was it's a topic that I've wanted to talk about for a while too, well before this actually popped up. We've had it on the backlog, I think, since almost day one. And that's the topic there is about large enterprises and commercial enterprises taking advantage of the open source ecosystem and not actually contributing back.
Yeah, that is an interesting topic. Yeah.
And I guess just for everyone's benefit, right, in this instance that we're talking now, the current WordPress drama, so to speak.
Yeah. So why don't we have a brief rundown of what's happened?
Yeah.
So most people have heard of WordPress. WordPress has been around is it about 20 years now? Maybe around the 20-year mark, I think.
Quite possibly, but you hear statistics that it runs something like 75% of the
75%
internet.
75% of the web or something like that. Yeah. The web.
Ridiculous. Yes. Yeah, the web, sorry.
Hmm. Yeah. So obviously it's ubiquitous. It's used everywhere. And, you know, it was probably, I mean, there was certainly a time where if someone said CMS or content management system, they were talking about WordPress.
Yep, absolutely. Right.
Now, nowadays in the dev space, there's, you know, I mean, even before WordPress, there were lots of CMSs as well. Mm-hmm. And now there are even more. And in the dev space, there are certainly, you can take your pick. They're prolific, right? In fact, my company now owns one.
Yes.
Employer now owns one, right?
That's right. But I guess the big thing with WordPress is it's not really developer focused, right?
Well, that's a whole other episode in itself. And if you go back about 10, 15 years, WordPress developer was probably one of the most in demand.
Yes.
Jobs. So that's a whole other topic. But I mean, I think where you're going with that is that it was all very GUI driven, click, you know, you didn't need to be a developer to be able to spin up a WordPress website, pick a theme, you know, and start building some content, right? Mm-hmm. And that's probably what got it where it is. And to your point, even though there are lots of other CMSs now, WordPress still drives that, whatever it is, 70% of the web, which is a lot. Right. So people are creating websites, and there are, you know, there are lots of hosting providers that have their own built-in CMSs. There are lots of these other ones, but WordPress still dominates. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm probably going to get shot for saying this, and there's no doubt people out there that will tell me how wrong I am, and I am unquestionably wrong, but I'm going to say it anyway because I feel like it's funny. I feel like WordPress is keeping PHP afloat, right?
Look, yeah, it's probably one of the more famous platforms for PHP aside from Facebook.
Facebook, yeah. I mean, does Facebook still run on PHP these days?
I don't know. That's why I was hesitant to get down that path, but I'm not sure. But
that was the big one. No, but look, there are plenty of other things out there running. No, wait, I was going to say, I was about to start listing off things I know of running PHP, but they're all WordPress things. So never mind. No, but I mean, look, so WordPress is everywhere. And WordPress has achieved widespread popularity and ubiquity through, I guess, its ease of use and its appeal to non-developers. So I think we can agree on that.
Yeah.
And of course, it's free, or is it? It's free, right?
Yes. Yes. And well, it's open source, so therefore.
Okay. So it's not just open source. It's not just free. It's FOSS, right? It's free open source software.
Yes.
Okay. So I can go on GitHub, or is it on GitHub or wherever it is, but I can find the code for WordPress and I can clone it, modify it, contribute back if I want to, make code changes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
As with any other open source software out there.
Yeah. Now that's interesting, right? Because the term open source actually has a defined meaning.
Yeah.
And it doesn't just mean that the code is available for you to look at. That actually has its nuance and its semantics, but it actually has another term, which is source open, right?
Yeah.
So if you can look at the source, but there are restrictions on what you can do with it, that's called source open. Open source specifically means that you can look at the source code, you can modify and redistribute it, do whatever you want with it, essentially. Mm-hmm. And there are some well-known open source licenses. And to technically be open source, you have to have one of those licenses.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, something that is not technically open source would be Identity Server, right? So Duende, if you go on GitHub, you can see Duende Identity Server. All the code is there.
Yep.
But it has a proprietary license, mm-hmm. which has restrictions around what you can do with it when you qualify as community and what you can and can't do with it when you qualify as commercial, and what licensing and payment requirements are involved under those different circumstances.
Yep.
So technically, that is not open source.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm with you.
Okay. So open source, right? Now, we talk about 70% of the web running on WordPress. What percentage of software runs on open source code?
The number would be near on 100%.
It would, right? So the exactly, right? So the amount of software that does not run at all on any open source will be so small to be statistically insignificant. It would be infinitesimal,
yep.
right? So what we're saying, right, is that the majority of software in the world is based on code which is freely available for anyone to read, modify, redistribute, commercialize, and it's, you know, this is what ostensibly all of the world's software runs on.
Absolutely. And
how much of that software is not open source? Like, how much of it is proprietary and commercial and earning money?
Probably
and not
up to 75% of that software.
Well, I mean, more. Right. How much of that software is earning money for people that did not write the code and do not maintain the code?
A good majority of it.
Yeah.
Right.
So why then are people giving up their free time and not making money and writing code and just putting it out there for other people to make money off?
There is a very good reason for that. And I'm trying to remember which book it's in and I cannot for the life of me.
So there's
this
question comes up a lot, and I see it on developer forums. Right. I often see people just sort of getting interested in software development and starting to explore. And I sometimes see this question come up, and it's like, how many people here are maintaining or contributing to open source libraries or packages or what have you? And, you know, people chime in and you know, the question is, but why? And you know what? There are a range of different answers. Okay. Now, a lot of people will often say, well, I wrote this code. I thought it would be useful to other people, so I shared it. And that's probably the most common answer. Right. But then there are other answers. One of those answers might be .NET, right? .NET is open source. Bicep is open source.
Yep.
Right. You don't have to pay to use Bicep. The code is it actually open source or is it source open? I'd have to check.
I'm not sure about Bicep.
Well, I'm not sure about .NET either, because there's the .NET Foundation. I'm pretty sure .NET is open source, right? It's fully open source.
Yeah, I believe it is. I say that with confidence, but I do believe it is. Yeah.
Yeah, we should know this. But anyway, so in these cases, people will give this code and this software away for free because it drives revenue through other means. And that's probably a much less common answer than the, well, I wrote this code. I thought it would be useful to other people, so I shared it.
Yep.
Now, I see you've picked up a book. Do you have an answer?
Yeah, Drive from Dan Ping. So it opens out, Matt, into basically the exact same question that you're asking there. I'm just going to have to read this because it's too hard for me to summarize. But it says, imagine it's 1996. You sit down with an economist and you say to her, I've got a crystal ball here that can peer 15 years into the future. I'd like to test your forecasting powers, right? And then he goes on to describe, you have to predict what would be more successful in 2011, based on two encyclopedias. The first encyclopedia comes from Microsoft, a large profitable company, and with last year's introduction of Windows 95, it's becoming an era-defining colossus. Microsoft will fund this encyclopedia, pay professional writers, editors to craft thousands of topics, well-compensated managers to oversee the project to ensure it's completed on budget and on time. And then Microsoft will sell this encyclopedia on CD-ROMs and later online. Then he compares that to the second encyclopedia won't come from any company, but it'll be created by tens of thousands of people who write and edit articles for fun. These hobbyists won't need special qualifications to participate, and nobody will be paid a dollar to write or edit the articles. Participants will have to contribute their labor, sometimes 20 to 30 hours per week, for free. The encyclopedia itself, which will exist online, will also be free. No charge for anyone who wants to use it. And he goes to pose a question, which one in 15 years' time would be popular and which one would be defunct?
Interesting. So this might have to get cut from the episode and go into the outtakes. But before you picked up the book and found that, you said it was between Britannica and Wikipedia. And I said, well, it's interesting that no one mentioned Encarta.
I know. So my memory's not that great. But yeah. And, you know, I guess that goes to, I guess if you want the answer to your question there, you'll have to read through the whole book because I'm not going to do that for you right now.
Right. Okay.
But he does go on to talk about the differences between intrinsic and extrinsic motivations.
Yeah.
We do things not just for monetary reward.
Well, I think there's a whole other topic here. And in fact, this is something that I haven't raised with you yet, but I would like to talk about sometime, which is about different people have different motivations, right?
Yep.
And people, I would even arguably say that the vast majority of people are motivated by similar things. And then there are outliers who have different motivations. And through a survivorship bias, those are the ones that rise to the top.
Yeah.
Or become the most noticeable. That's a whole other topic, right? But I think where you're going with this is we are agreed that if I go back to what I said, I see on forums, which is people saying, why do people do this? And the most common answer is, well, I wrote this code, thought other people would find it useful, so I shared it.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of people are quite happy to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, the ones that are not doing that and are doing it for profit because it's indirectly leading to some other revenue stream. Now, they're probably 1% of 1%, maybe even less. Right.
Yep.
But because they are the ones making the biggest impact, they seem like the bigger ones. And they probably are the bigger ones. And it makes them seem like, well, that's the majority. And that's what open source is all about. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with all that said and all of that background, let's go back to WordPress.
Yeah.
So WordPress is open source. Well, originally it was a blogging engine, right? So it was for blogs, but really it's a content management system. So it lets you create a website and lets you create content without having to write the code. Maybe we should just take a step back, right? So before content management systems, if you wanted a website, you had to have someone come and write your CSS and HTML, or even just HTML, right? So even pre-CSS, but probably not, right? But you had to have someone come along and write code for you.
Mm-hmm.
To represent the pages on your website, because websites were made of pages, and that person would have to upload it to a host that would be online. And that would usually be done via SFTP, right?
Sure.
So you need someone very technical, okay? So let's say you've got a website and you're a pizza restaurant and you change your menu. So someone, a developer, a technical person has to come along, rewrite that code and upload it to your hosting provider. And now your website's up to date.
Yep.
Or let's say you're a blogger. Right. And let's say you want to write articles on the regular, like every week or every month. Right. So you now need someone technical to write the code for you that will display that on your website and upload it for you. So CMSs came along and made it so that you don't have to do that. Once the site's up and running, someone can log in and just write using a WYSIWYG editor.
Yep.
And that's why for a long time, CMSs and blogging became kind of almost synonymous. And that's why WordPress rose to prominence as a blogging engine, even though now it's used way beyond that. And as we've said multiple times, powers 70% of the web, quote unquote. Yeah. We need to cite a source for that. So anyway, so WordPress is open source. Now, WordPress was written by a guy called Matt Mullenweg. And Matt Mullenweg co-founded and is CEO of a company called Automattic. Mm-hmm. And Automattic as a company, and Matt Mullenweg still as an individual, are the main contributors to and maintainers of WordPress.
Yep.
Right. So they own something called WordPress.com, which is a commercial WordPress hosting site. They also own a product called WooCommerce. So WooCommerce is a plugin for WordPress that lets you basically do e-commerce, right, without having to build an e-commerce engine.
Yep.
Now, when WordPress first started out, you had to upload your plugins and your templates and your themes via SFTP, and you had to use code to configure them. And it was, you know, it was a lot better than, you know, back in the old HTML and Notepad days. But you still kind of had to have someone technically savvy. So then along came WordPress.org. Now, WordPress.org also lets you host WordPress blogs for free out to a point. But the main thing that WordPress.org does is it's a distribution platform for themes and templates and plugins. So think of it like NuGet for WordPress, right? Or NPM for WordPress or Yarn. Or it's a package source, right? But the main benefit of it was with WordPress.org, you as a theme distributor or a plugin distributor or author can publish it on WordPress.org, and then someone with a WordPress website anywhere in the world, not on one of the hosted ones, doesn't matter, can tap into that and can just search easily from within the WordPress admin console for themes and templates and plugins, and with one click install them to your website, and then with one click update them.
Yeah.
Right. So really, really cool. Really, it really changed the game. And it was a massive contributor to WordPress growing to where it is now. Okay. So the recent drama has occurred because WP Engine, which kind of sounds, it's kind of brand jacking in a way, right? It really sounds like it's very WordPress official.
Yeah. Yes, it does. But it also, it really ties your business down to that platform too.
Yeah. Do you remember on the Netflix problem episode, do you remember the Getflix?
Yes. Exactly.
Kind of like Getflix.
Exactly the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It does. You're right. You're absolutely right. So WP Engine, they're a hosting provider for WordPress, right? So WordPress open source free. You can download the code and you can upload it to your own hosting provider. You know, not going to cost you anything other than the cost of your hosting. Or you can use a managed provider like WP Engine or WordPress.com, where you pay them a monthly fee and you get access to continually maintained latest updated version of WordPress, and they host it for you. They do all the DNS. They do, like, if you're not a developer and you're not, you know, a tech person, it's a great option. Right. So WP Engine have made massive amounts of money, right? They've grown huge off the back of WordPress.
Yep.
Now, Matt Mullenweg sees this as them getting rich off what he thinks is a free open source product. Now, he runs a business based on it as well, right? But the way he sees it is that he also gives that code away for free for people to use for nothing.
Yep.
And the way he sees it is that WP Engine are making all this money and not giving anything back, because they do not contribute source code back into the WordPress repository for everyone else to share and use.
Now, arguably, and I find this hard to say because I don't want to defend this position, but arguably,
before you say it, we should come back to it.
Okay, let's come back to that.
Because I know what you're going to say.
Yep.
And I know what you're going to say. Right now, and that is really the main topic of this conversation.
It is, absolutely is.
But before we get onto that, let's talk about what happened and let's talk about the drama.
Okay.
So Matt Mullenweg, he sees WP Engine growing huge, making all this money off WordPress, not contributing source code back into it. And he thinks, well, that's not cool. So he blocked WP Engine from accessing WordPress.org.
So just to be clear there, he's still letting them access the WordPress source. He's not stopping them from hosting WordPress websites.
Correct.
He's not stopping them from adding those plugins. But what he is stopping them, or what he is preventing, is websites on their platform from accessing the WP Engine, sorry, the WordPress.org plugin platform.
Correct.
Okay.
So that means that all of the customers using WP Engine to host their WordPress website can no longer access the catalog of themes and templates and plugins.
Yeah.
So they cannot search for and install plugins or themes, and they cannot update the themes that they already have.
Yeah.
And he says, well, of course they can, right? Because they can just get the source and upload them.
Yep.
So that was the consequence of this effectively dummy spit. And I am under no compunction whatsoever to phrase that differently, because that is what it was, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But was it justified? And again,
well, this is another question. Sorry.
I was going to say, now, can we answer that question now, or are we still sort of nutting this out?
We can get to that question, but one of the steps to get there is to go back to what you were about to say earlier, right? So justify, now that is a very loaded question, right? Was he justified? That ultimately, that's a matter of opinion, right? But let's get less abstract than that, and let's get more specific, right? So I said something which you took exception to and we're about to counter, which is that Matt Mullenweg feels that because WP Engine are not contributing source code back into the WordPress repo for everyone else to use, that they weren't pulling their weight and they weren't contributing.
And I guess I hesitate because I don't want to sound like I'm defending them, but their argument would then side with, well, they're within their legal rights not to.
Okay, yep. Their argument goes way beyond that, actually, and is actually very reasonable. So their argument is that they may not be opening pull requests and contributing code back into the WordPress ecosystem. And actually, before I get onto their argument, yeah, you're right. They were within their legal rights. They were not violating any license terms. They're not doing anything quote unquote wrong. But I don't think we're talking about legal rights here. We're talking about ethical. We're talking about a moral position, right?
Absolutely. And this conversation is going to start to turn into a big bowl of spaghetti as we loop back and forth, but they've made their ethical decision, their moral decision, not to commit back to the main repository, right?
I don't think they've made that decision actively not to. They're just, it's not something, it hasn't been something they've done.
It's not something they've done.
Yeah.
So then why would it be that morally wrong for Matt to pull access to them?
That's a separate question, right? But I want to keep talking about this idea of contributing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So very right at the start of the conversation, we were talking about the different ways that people can contribute to open source, right?
Yep.
One of those ways, and traditionally the way that is seen as, you know, really the way, is writing code, opening pull requests.
Yeah.
Like, you use an open source library or package or product, you find a bug, you fix it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want a new feature, you develop it and you share it back. You find a problem in the docs or there's something that's not explained, you write it, right?
Yep.
Already, I'm starting to get away from that core concept of attributing code because I've already said docs and you unquestionably went, yep.
True.
Yeah. The way that WP Engine see it is they're taking that step further. The way that they see it is that they are, in their view, the biggest contributor to WordPress because of all their work of creating themes and creating a whole ecosystem. They're contributing to the ecosystem. They're promoting its adoption. They're driving its adoption. They have tutorials, documentation. They create themes, plugins, many of them, some of them, free. You know, obviously a lot of them you've got to pay for, but a lot of them you don't, right? Because the way they see it, if the ecosystem is rich and if there's a lot out there that makes people want to use WordPress, that makes people want to use their hosting platform. Now, how is that different to, say, .NET or Bicep and Azure? Well, it's different in that Microsoft own all of that stuff, but other than that, what's the difference? And in fact, from Microsoft's perspective, let's say Microsoft are Matt Mullenweg. Like, you know, Microsoft might look at, and this is hypothetical because this is obviously complete bollocks, but they might look at the .NET team and say, well, you guys aren't contributing anything back to Azure. You're not like writing pull requests, opening pull requests on our internal private repos that run our whole Azure ecosystem. That's obviously completely not true, but like hypothetically, right? But you know, they could turn around and say, well, we are providing a platform for people to write code that runs on Azure. Now Microsoft might turn around and say, well, you know, 75% of Azure is running on, you know, Express or Node or whatever, or Python. I don't know if any of that is true, and hopefully not, because I don't want them to look at those numbers and say, let's shut down .NET. But you know, you get the point, right? The point is nobody is asking that question because it's a fucking stupid question, right?
Yeah.
And you know, is there an argument for WP Engine to defend here? Is there a position for them to defend here?
So to summarize, you're saying that their argument is that they're contributing to the community.
They're contributing to the ecosystem.
To the ecosystem, not necessarily to the core code base.
Not to the core code base, but they are giving back as much or more, quote unquote, to the community as what the code is, because they're giving these templates and themes and education and tutorials and driving adoption, and they see that as their contribution.
Depends on how cynical you really want to be here, right?
It depends
because the cynic in me says they only came up with that argument once the lawyers were involved.
I don't know,
but I mean, that's just it. Like, the cynic in me believes or wants to believe that that was the argument that was drummed up by the lawyers so that they had a leg to stand on.
But it wasn't a legal issue. Well, actually, no, there have been lawsuits filed. So, yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Right. Whether or not, and, you know, this is obviously us speculating, but whether or not they had that thought before any of this unfolded and they had that belief before any of this unfolded, we'll never know.
Yep.
And I guess what I'm trying to say here is maybe that belief has come from being pushed into a corner and then trying to defend themselves.
Okay. So what does the non-cynic in you believe or want to believe?
It's a valid argument. I see it as a valid argument to benefit the community, to work on the community is one aspect of that entire ecosystem.
Yep.
I guess from where I'm sitting, where my opinion, maybe WP Engine has overvalued that commitment, how much they've committed there, or the value of that commitment, I should say.
Yeah, we need to loop back, and there's so many more things here we need to unpack, right? But I'm going to chuck it. Let's take a tangent here. And let's not forget open source, even though this is very relevant to open source. Let's talk about GitHub, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to give you a couple of names. Damian Brady.
Yep.
Michelle Duke. You know who they are?
Yep.
They are paid employees of GitHub,
mm-hmm.
whose job it is to promote and advocate for and evangelize GitHub in the community.
Yep.
Now, I don't know whether they actually contribute code back into GitHub itself, but I'm going to presume not. Right? Because that's not their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not you think they are still contributing value to GitHub, GitHub thinks they are, because GitHub is employing them to be True. Out there driving adoption, educating people, be out there in the community, getting people to understand GitHub better and use it better. And GitHub are paying them to do that and mm-hmm. not paying them to write code back into GitHub.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there is a whole career based around this for various different software companies yeah. and platforms. So whether you or I believe it is almost immaterial, right? Because the big software companies sure believe it, because they employ mm-hmm. people to be out there
advocating for their software, yeah.
community advocates, yeah, contributing to the ecosystem, their own, that is, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't think there are any companies that employ people full time to just go out there and find open source projects to contribute to for the sake of everyone else.
No. So
now there are some companies that will use an open source package and find a need to modify it.
Mm-hmm.
And fork it and just keep their modifications to themselves.
Yeah.
Which is, I want to say, arguably a dick move. But I also feel like it's inarguably a dick move. But, you know, equally, there are companies out there that will use open source software,
yep.
open source code, modify it, contribute back to it, and, you know, put that back out there for the community.
Absolutely.
Yeah, one of those is Microsoft.
Yeah.
You know, there was a point there where the number one contributor to the Linux kernel was Microsoft.
It was Microsoft, yeah.
There was a point out there before Microsoft bought GitHub. Oh, Scott told us this on the episode where we spoke to him about Microsoft basically. Did Microsoft create LFS? No, they didn't create LFS. They created something else.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I can't remember exactly what it was.
I can't. Now, look, you know,
The Git file system or the Git, was it LFS?
I don't think it was LFS. We should go back and check.
Yeah.
Now, look, Microsoft aren't doing this purely altruistically, right? Yeah, Microsoft made those changes to GitHub because it enabled them to move code on there that they wanted to move. Yeah. Microsoft made those changes to Linux because it made it easier to host Linux on Azure.
Yeah.
Right. So they weren't doing that purely out of the goodness of their hearts for the community. Right. They were doing it because it served their own means. But what they could have done was not given that back. They could have created their own forks. They could have created their own Linux distros to run on Azure.
Yep.
Now, again, arguably, almost inarguably, that wouldn't have been as effective as contributing those things back into the main kernel.
Because there's a lot of other cloud providers that you'd want your code running on. Too,
well, right. not just that, but, you know, there's all these distros out there. Whereas if you say, oh, you can run our managed Red Hat distro.
Yeah.
You know, but you can't run, you know, your custom Arch or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if it's just in the kernel, then anyone can run whatever they want on That's Azure. And, yeah. So, you know, they're not just doing these things out of the goodness of their heart. They are doing them for their own means. But nevertheless, it's still going out there into the community.
It is. And I guess this conversations drifted a little from my original thinking when I posted this topic, because I remember vividly back then when I posted it was a bit of a gut reaction to an employer I was working for at the time, no longer with them, where there was a mentality from, you know, large multi-billion dollar enterprise, right? And there's a mentality there that was basically these tools that we're using are costing too much money. Let's find a free open source alternative to use.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm a multi-billion dollar organization. I'm going to save tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in licensing fees because I can just spin up an open source alternative.
Yeah.
Right. Which again, arguably they're all within their right to do because that's within their licensing right.
Yep.
But in that instance, they're not providing anything back to the community.
Mm-hmm.
The intention is purely there to cut costs, to save money, which is arguable in itself because of the maintenance overhead involved in spinning these things up and maintaining them yourself. But, you know, saving these licensing fees purely to for their own personal gain.
Yeah.
Right. And this is where the original thought process came for this topic. Now, this has taken a slight tangent because in these instances that you're discussing, it's about giving back to the community in one way, in some way, be that advocating for the ecosystem or actually contributing code, right? My original thought process, like I said, was about that. And, you know, so to use the terminology that I had in the backlog there, Matt, the exploitation of the open source community by large enterprises. And around that same time, I saw a lot of people on social media, on Twitter at the time, particularly posting about the entitlement people get from using open source software. And just you see the maintainers venting publicly on social media, just saying like the entitlement of these users that they're demanding features, they're demanding bugs get fixed, they're demanding certain things, yet those people that are making those same demands are not offering anything at all, even if that is advocating like we've been speaking of, or monetary commitments, or helping out with the code base. And these people who feel entitled are jumping up and down and, you know, making a lot of noise saying the open source system's not working for me. And
yeah.
And that was the original intent of this topic. But now I guess this is sort of taken at that next level on top.
Yeah. I mean, it's a valid question, right? I mean, we spoke earlier on, what's the motivation for people? Why are people giving up their time and writing code and putting it out there for free for other people to use? Well, you know, because they thought it was useful and wanted to share and thought other people would like it. But then when you frame that in the context of, okay, why are you doing it when there are massive enterprises out there making millions of dollars off it and entitled pricks demanding you fix a bug or write better documentation or give a better feature without giving you anything in return? Now, I can't really answer that question. Right. Well, I mean, okay, I was going to say I can answer that question because I do have some open source stuff out there, but I haven't really had to deal with people giving me that kind of stuff. Now, I have had some, you know, I have had some comments that have tweaked me a little bit, like on my blog and on my YouTube channel.
Yeah.
But it's not in the same league, right? So, you know, why? I can't answer that, right? But what I can tell you is that maybe there is a selection bias here and it's the squeaky wheels. I don't know.
Yeah.
But what I do know is that there is a lot of that going. There's two things we're talking about here, right? One is people being dicks and complaining about things and not giving anything back.
Yeah.
And the other is large corporations making millions or billions of dollars off the free labor of people doing things for the good of the community, right?
Yep.
Yeah, these are real concerns. These are real things, right? Now, the question, though, is there's a number of questions. One question is, these people are doing these things, right? Now, unless we change the nature of open source, and if we do, we don't have open source anymore, that problem isn't going away.
No, it's not. Now, so just a thought that's popped in mind, right now, and this is not just hypothetical, this has actually occurred, is you hear a lot about burnout in the open source community.
Yep.
For the reasons we've just discussed, right? No one's supporting them. No one's making contributions. Everyone's feeling entitled, making demands that just cannot be met.
Yep.
Right. And you hear about the burnout from the maintainer. So then they reach out and ask for someone else to help out and someone else to take over the project.
Yep.
And then they burn out, they throw their hands in the air, some they hand over the keys to the castle.
Yep.
Right. And then all of a sudden we end up with the supply chain attack.
Yep.
Right. I'm just trying to think of what that recent or relatively recent example is, but there was a major one. And this one contributor just slowly contributed over time and then snuck a backdoor in. And then over the years, finally got their way into a point where they were maintaining the code base, got it all out there, opened up the back door to millions of systems worldwide.
Yeah, I remember. Is this something we spoke about on the show?
Possibly.
It's something that we spoke about. Yeah, this was a few months ago. And there was questions around whether this was an individual or not.
I'm just trying to think of what that one was. But my point here is, if we don't do anything about it, then the amount of organizations, these large multi-billion-dollar organizations we're talking of, the entire internet, as we said earlier, you know, pretty much 100% of all software is has some form of open source software inside it. If those maintainers do burn out,
yeah,
and they start making rash decisions for who is going to take over from them, this is a real threat.
Yeah, you know what? Not even just from a security perspective, but from a commercial perspective. Let's talk about, let's go back 15 years, 15 to 20 years, whenever it was. So, you know who Bill Joy is?
Name rings a bell. No.
So he was one of the founders of Sun Microsystems.
Okay, yep.
So he rewrote Unix to make it support multitasking.
Mm-hmm.
He then founded Sun Microsystems.
Mm-hmm.
He then created Java,
yep,
the platform and the language, which is free and open source and out there for, yep, everyone to use, and was on billions and billions of devices around the world, right? Ran, yep, everything. Everything ran on Java, right? So, you know, websites, servers, banks, mobile devices,
yep,
Java was everywhere, right? And then, now I don't know, you know, we've spoken about this before as well, because it's one of those things that I bring up and it's one of those classic stories. So Sun Microsystems was kind of this, you know, glorious utopia of tech companies, right? Where it was,
yeah,
founded and opened and run by engineers, and mm-hmm, everything they did was all like engineering focused and everything was wonderful. And somehow they were commercially successful as well, right?
Yeah.
So you had the whole SunSpark system, and they had the hardware, and you know, it was amazing, right? And there's you know, plenty of books and documentary as well, and you know, anyway, encourage people to find out more about Sun. And then the absolute antithesis to this company bought them. So Sun Microsystems sold to Oracle.
Yep. Yeah.
Right. And Sun Microsystems, frankly, had one thing that Oracle wanted, and that, yeah, was Java.
Mm.
Yeah. And you know, when it was announced that Oracle were buying Sun, it was like, well, do they want SunSpark? Because then, you know, they've got a fully vertically integrated solution. You can have your storage and your servers and your database like all on the same stack, managed and owned by the same company. And it's like, no, that's probably not it. And it's like, well, what else? You know, do they want Solaris, the operating system, which is part of that stack? Probably not, you know, making that enough money. Well, what about Java? Yeah, but Java's free and open source. They don't make money off Java. And it's like, yeah, but what if they change that?
Yeah.
And yeah, it didn't work out. It didn't work out for them. They tried, right? And then it was, of course, you know, there was the big drama with Google, because Android was all based on Java.
Mm.
And there was a whole drama around that as well. The short version of this is it didn't go down the way Oracle probably wanted it to. And of course, Java's still around, you know, it's not going to go anywhere.
No.
But they never quite managed to. And of course, you know, I guess the world changed completely, right? So Java is still around and it's still around a lot. But, you know, iOS came along, right? Smartphones came along.
Yeah.
Google started, you know, moving away from Java, right? AOSP, there's still AOSP, but, you know, there's Kotlin now as well. And, well, Jetpack Compose for building the apps, you know. Yeah, there's iOS, there's IoT. Most of IoT now runs on Python, you know, yep. But there's, you know, there's .NET that runs, there's .NET Core IoT, or there's .NET Micro, and there's .NET Micro Framework, sorry. And there's, you know, countless other things, you know. It just didn't work out the way that they wanted it to work out, right? They didn't get suddenly turn the screws on billions of people the world over and start getting these licensing fees, right?
Yep.
But, you know, is that the worst case in history of someone trying to do what, you know, the extreme version of, you know, what your concern is here?
It's in an extreme case, yes. It's not as subtle.
It's but, definitely not subtle.
I guess it's not as nefarious as my concern either, right?
No, I guess not, right?
As a supply chain attack, the concern there is you could leak data, you could take down systems.
Oh, sorry, I wasn't talking about the supply chain attack. I was talking about exploiting open source.
Absolutely. But arguably, though, Java as an open source project was being maintained by a large organization themselves, right?
Yes, it
was. So there was less likelihood of an individual or a small team of people getting burnt out because they were being taken advantage of.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
But I mean,
interesting, right? So, because this goes back to an early part of the discussion, right? So, we were talking about the survivorship bias of the large open source projects dominating the mind space when people think to open source. But these are often, not always, maintained by large teams and sometimes sponsored by big enterprises.
Yeah.
So even then, actually, I don't want to say that they don't have the risk of people being burned out, because I know people personally that work on very prominent open source projects that are owned and sponsored by very large enterprises that still are arguably exploited, but definitely at risk of burnout. But that aside, you know, what you're saying is that's different to, you know, an open source library that's maintained by an individual or a very small team in their spare time, not as part of their job and not paid for by a large enterprise. There's that. What is that? That is it XKCD, that cartoon?
Yep.
You know the one I'm talking about? Where there's the big stack of blocks.
Oh, it's the, like the stack of the entire stack of the, either the software or the building or whatever. And then it comes down to just one little triangle piece down the very bottom that everything's built on.
Yeah. And it's saying basically, the entire modern internet, one library written by some dude in 1993. Yeah,
absolutely.
Propping up the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a question, right? Because, you know, clearly you are passionate about this. Clearly you have feelings on this matter.
Yes.
What do you want? Like, what do you want to be different?
I don't know. I guess I live in an altruistic world, right, in my head, where people don't take advantage of other people, where you know, yes, there is the open source there for those that need it. But if you're a large enterprise that's got that spare money, instead of looking around and saying, okay, well, I can find an open source solution that costs me $0 in licensing versus the $100,000 in licensing I was paying for that commercial product, like maybe there's some way you can contribute back. Maybe you can be contributing some of that savings back to the project that you're leveraging.
All right. Let me ask you a question. You have a super fund, right?
Yep.
Is it self-managed?
No.
Okay. So you are paying money into an account. Well, not you. Your employer is actually you, because you are your employer, paying money into an account, but you're also paying a fund manager to invest that money for you in a way that you expect that money to grow and be well invested, right?
Yep.
Okay. So you expect them to invest that money in companies that are making profit for their shareholders.
Yeah.
So you expect those companies to maximize their profits for their shareholders.
I see where you're going.
Yeah. All right. So these companies equally have a responsibility if they're starting out on a project and they need a library to support this project, a software library, and they have option A, which costs $100,000 a year, and option B, which doesn't cost anything.
Yep.
They have an obligation to you personally to go with option. I can't remember which option was which, but the one that doesn't cost them.
Yes, they do.
So would you want your super fund manager investing money in the company that spends $100,000 on software library that they could have just used an open source free alternative for nothing?
Well, considering it's my superannuation, which is a long-term investment, I'd like them to be investing in a company that's making long-term decisions.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
And arguably saving $100,000 today may be a worse decision.
Yeah. Well, then all of this is arguably and maybe in one day. Right.
Yeah.
But I don't entirely disagree with you, but I think that there are other ways to monetize open source.
I'm not even just talking about monetization contributions either. Right. And this is something that I absolutely have in mind for my business as we start to grow, is to have dedicated time to contributing back, to reward employees for contributing back to the community. Right. You hear, you know, Google famously had their 20% time. Atlassian did similar. In a consultancy, right, you've got, you know, what I refer to as, you know, bench warmers.
Right.
Not everyone, you don't have 100% utilization all the time. You're going to have people sitting on the bench.
Yeah.
They're going, you don't need to, but you want to keep their skills up to date. You want to keep them busy.
Yeah.
So there's a perfect opportunity to contribute back to the community.
Yeah.
Right. It can be done. Arguably, it can be done. And it doesn't have to, like I said, it does have to be monetary, but it could be, right? Other organizations have fundraising targets or donation targets, I should say. So arguably, again, they could use those monetary funds if they need to.
But not monetary, you raise a good point here, right? So these large organizations that have these fundraising targets, it's an optics thing, right?
Donation targets more. Because fundraising sounds like they're trying to raise money for themselves.
But it's matching, but, right?
Sorry?
So they do donation matching.
Donation matching, yeah.
Now, you raise an interesting point here, right? Because once you set the trend, like no company wants to do this. Right, really. But once you set the trend to the point where it makes you look bad if you're not very openly and clearly making a song and dance out of the fact that you do this, then everyone has to do it. So if we can get open source contributions to be at that same level. And you know what? There was an episode a few episodes ago where we made the point that every company is a software company.
Yep.
In 2024, every new company at least. So that's potentially a trend that we could work on setting. That's something that maybe we can do that. Yeah.
And like I said,
I like it.
Honestly, like it's something, and I was talking to an ex-colleague just on the weekend when I was up in the mountains, and this exact same topic came up, saying like, as I grow and scale, I'd love to get to a point where instead of having sort of bench warmers sitting there twiddling their thumbs, not doing anything or finding a frivolous project for them to work on, they can be contributing back to the community.
Yeah.
Like there's 101 standard project or open source projects that we use across every single project.
Yeah.
Some of them are big names, but not all of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I've got an employer that's passionate about some topic or some project, then I think it's a great use of their spare time.
Okay. So let me ask you a couple of questions. What was the last open source package that you used explicitly? So, I mean, obviously we're using software right now and there's like...
Yeah. But outside of, say, writing a .NET application using .NET, open source .NET, probably the likes of AutoMapper or AutoFact, anything from Jimmy Bogart, really.
When was the last time you contributed to AutoMapper?
Admittedly, never.
When was the last time you contributed code to an open source repo?
I haven't. And that's something I'm looking to rectify.
Never?
No.
Okay. When was the last time you contributed in any way to an open source project or repo? Are we going to have to cut this whole section out?
I can't remember. No, because it's something, now I don't want to sound hypocritical here, but it's something that I've often really thought about. And that's why I'm passionate about it, because I'm pissed off at myself, right? To an extent that I want to right those wrong. Right?
That's a very candid and personal insight you just shared there, I think.
And well, the simple fact is I could make these contributions myself, or I could be in a position where I can have a team, an army of people to make these contributions.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, absolutely. Like this is one of the main reasons why this has come up. Like I can make any excuse that I want for not being able to, for not committing, you know, I don't have time, whatever else. But at the end of the day, they're excuses.
Yep. Okay.
And yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, I can't hide behind that. Right. But yeah, I mean, it's something that I do want to rectify, and rectify it in more than just me committing it. I want to be able to enable a lot of people to contribute.
Yep. Okay. That's fair. Where I'm reading between the lines here is what you're saying is you have become frustrated working in large companies where you have been directed to use open source options and have potentially wanted to give back in exchange for that and not being allowed to. And what you're saying is that you want, in your ideal team that you will grow and build, people use open source software but also contribute back as well. And I think also, you know, when you're talking here about the option between do you write that code or do you run a team, you're also, it's really about that stage in your career, right, where you're moving towards probably writing less code and more having teams that write code, irrespective of whether it's open source or anything else.
Absolutely. And I think you're pretty close to spot on there, right? And yeah, I mean, it's just we're at different points in our career now, and it's time for me to empower other people, right?
I want to just revisit a couple of points, right?
Yeah.
So how do you feel now compared to how you felt at the start of this discussion about the definition of what contributing to open source means?
I still feel that contributing to the community, it's the terminology I'm using to just like that I can bundle it in my head, like that advocating side. I don't know if that is enough.
Okay. What if you are a consumer of some open source code and you file an issue or a bug on the repo, right? Now, when you file this, you give very, very detailed repro steps, a minimal repo that you link to, detailed logs, everything that maintainers could possibly need to solve that bug. Is that a contribution?
Yes, but there shouldn't be an expectation that it'll get rectified, that it'll get resolved.
Okay. Okay, sure.
Right.
Now, so, I think when it comes to entitlement, you're not going to see that level of commitment to the issue. You're just going to get, I found this problem, fix it, right?
Correct. And I think, again, that's a lot of, and look, I'm not one of those entitled consumers of open source, right? I'm not there bad-mouthing people and saying, why is this bug not fixed? Why are you not building these features for me? I use the software as it is. But yeah, I mean, if I'm going to write a bug report or a feature request, absolutely, if it's, I'm going to be following what their guidelines are or what their requirements are for those. And yes, that is a contribution because you're contributing to well, you're contributing to the backlog, but that's the overall feature set, right? The product, the direction of the product.
So let's go back to this WordPress question then.
I was going to say, but the caveat there is I still feel that that's probably a similar contribution to the advocacy side of things, right? I still don't see that as being a I'm committing effort to the actual product.
All right. What if you write a blog post about an open source package or a series of blog posts? No. Or what if you create a podcast about an open source package? Like, you know, is there any level of effort that someone can go to support an open source package or repo or some code or what have you that you would see as valuable or as valuable as contributing code directly?
I think I've just come to the realization that the answer is no.
Yeah.
Because we need to go back to the underlying root cause of why you are writing that open source project, that open source software. Yeah. You're not doing it. You're not doing it for publicity. You're not doing it for download. You're not doing it for stars. You're not doing it for any other reason, apart from the fact that you've written some cool piece of software that you want people to discover.
But why?
Because you used to. It's an intrinsic motivator.
I don't know if I agree with that, right? And the reason that I don't know if I agree with that is because we don't know what motivates every individual. No. And we also know that some of the most successful packages, open source products out there in the world, even indirectly, have certainly contributed to the authors of those packages.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Look, I mean, WordPress. Matt Marlinwig's made a ton of money based off his open source application.
Yes, but I'm talking even more indirectly, right? So I'm talking about software that is free and open source and that does not make a penny or a cent for anyone.
Yep.
The authors of those packages gain notoriety and gain, you know, the respect of the community. And that stuff indirectly earns them, well, I mean, that's a reward in itself.
Absolutely.
And I mean, indirectly earns them money, right?
Oh, look at James Newton King from Newtonsoft.
Who? From where?
Newtonsoft.
I know. Yeah. The single most downloaded NuGet package of all time.
Yes. And he, because of that, basically, I was talking to him a couple of years back at NDC. I think basically it was because of that. He was talking to someone at Microsoft, just dropped a little, you know, if you're looking to hire him, I wouldn't mind a job. And the next thing he knows, he's working at Microsoft.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Like, that's, I guess, what you're trying to get at there. He had no intention ever to go and work for Microsoft or have a package that was downloaded so many times, but it was. And
yeah,
but I don't know, like, again, it, like you said, we don't know what everyone's original motivations are. Some people may want the fame. They may want the fame and the fortune that comes with having a highly downloaded, highly leveraged package.
Yeah.
But like you said, a lot of the time, you said it at the very beginning, a lot of the time people will just write a piece of software and think this is cool. Others need to use it or others need to see it. And as a community, yeah, I mean, if someone's posting about it and if that's helping getting publicity, well, that's great. But I don't see that as really being a contribution.
Okay. So you then would side with Matt Mullenweg?
I would side with his argument,
not with his action. With
his actions.
Yeah. So then the other question that you asked was he justified? And, you know, again, I just think that's a matter of opinion. And I think justified, he certainly feels he was. Should he ethically and morally have not done what he did, right? You know, I think ultimately that question pales into in comparison against the question, was he a giant fucking baby?
Yeah, but ethically, morally, I mean, commercially, right? If he, what did he want to achieve out of this? Did he want them to pay a licensing fee? Did he want them to spend hours committing to the code, right? All he's done by taking this approach is alienate them. Maybe if they had have just gone behind closed doors and had conversations, there might have been...
But he didn't get the answer he wanted.
So maybe he was just being...
And he hasn't just alienated them. Like, obviously, it's been a very divisive issue in the community. So he's alienated half his community as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, actually, one more very, very big loop back, right?
Yeah.
How many websites or what percentage of websites do you feel run WordPress?
Do I actually feel I think the percentage as per the common...
We were saying about 75%.
I think 79.
43.3, according to this site that we'll link to.
Now, that is a much smaller number, but that's still a fuck of a lot, right?
Yeah. Well, 407. This is corelib.com, WordPress statistics. How many websites are using WordPress in 24? So this article was written in June this year, 472 million websites, which is 43.3% of the websites on the internet.
That can't be right.
I don't know where they're getting their figures from. WordPress has 62.7% share of the CMS market.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. But look, this has been a great topic, Matt. Something that, you know, as I said,
What's our conclusion?
Oh, I was just going to say.
Sorry. Yeah.
So it's been a really great topic, Matt.
But what's our conclusion?
Our conclusion is, well, it depends. But it's not just our conclusion here, right? I think it'd be great to hear what other people, what our audience think.
Nice cop out. I like it.
And I think it'd be great to hear what our audience think. And the best way for them to do that would be to catch us at ADA Conf in Melbourne on Friday the 8th of November this year, because I know you and I are both going to be there. We've got our tickets, got our flights, and I'm just about to book the accommodation.
Awesome. Yeah, that's definitely the best way. And I believe that if they want to come and see us there, they can get an exclusive Beer Driven Devs discount on their tickets, right?
That's right. Gosh, I almost forgot about that. Yeah, that's right. So using the coupon code BDD15, it's a 15% discount on their tickets. And you know, Matt, I've been thinking about this over the last couple of weeks, and I'm so excited for ADA Conf and meeting people out there. I'd love to give someone a free ticket.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, so what do you reckon? How should we do this? I was thinking if anyone can make it down there, look, I can't pay for flights, but if anyone's going to be in Melbourne and would like a free ticket to ADA Conf, if they could like share any of our social media posts between now and the end of October, I think we can pick one random post there, and that lucky winner, I'll shout them a ticket.
Wow, that's very generous.
Yeah, look, I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to meeting people down there.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm quite excited, actually. It's going to be good. I was actually just looking at the agenda today, and it's a brand new conference. It's just getting started. So it's, what is it? Architecture, design, and analysis.
Yep.
And I was just looking at the lineup today, and yeah, it's looking really cool. There's some great, great topics. In fact, there's one there that I know you've seen before because we've mentioned it, and I'm really looking forward to seeing that myself. But yeah, the whole lineup just looks great. And there's a really interesting panel discussion just before lunch that I'm looking forward to as well.
Rebuilds, rewrites, refactors, oh my. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm actually really excited for this. And the other thing is, and I know this kind of sounds silly, but one of the things I'm excited about is because it is relatively new and it is relatively small, is there's two tracks, right? There's, you know, there's the talks and then there's the longer workshop type sessions, which just makes it that much easier than having to pick, like, well, there's 15 different rooms.
That's right. No, it'd be good fun. I'm really, really looking forward to it. Catching up with people, going for a beer afterwards, actually going for a beer in person.
Yeah, that'd be good. Yeah. We should have some BDD beers.
Absolutely. With any listeners that want to join us?
Anyone who wants to join us at the conference, come and chat to us. Anyone who wants to come and have a beer with us afterwards, they're on you.
Look, we'll find a venue.
Shout the ticket, you shout the beers.
Yeah, we'll find a venue, make sure it's posted on social media.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, this will be good. I'm excited.
Yeah, I know. Can't wait.
Shit's about to get real.
Well, I think that's it for this week's episode of the Beer Driven Devs, Matt. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
3, 2... I'm just going to do a big clap so you can see it on the spike, because we're 29 minutes. Oh, no, we only just started. Don't mind me. I've already had too much to drink.